It's my pleasure to be here again. I was here like 2 years ago. This time, topic is quite different. It is somehow related to the Capucinus talk a moment ago, in the sense that we are trying to identify the phases. But the in spirit is quite different. I'm not trying to classify them all. Well, classification consists of two parts. You have to identify what phase you are in, and you have to show that these are exhaustive. That's called classification. Here, I'm not arguing that this invariance enumerates all possible phases. I'm just showing that it is a constant over some class of models. So let me give you motivation first. And before we go into that, I just wanted to make sure that you are all aware of what the quantum circuit is. Quantum circuit is just a bunch of local unitary transformations. And here I figuratively draw it as a brick wall where you prepare a state, presumably a product state, say, and then you apply certain local unitary layer by layer. Each layer cannot be collapsed because the unitaries in general don't commute. But one important feature of the local quantum circuit is that if you conjugate arbitrary local operator V by itself and its dagger, then because these bricks match together without having interfered with the V, they collapse and then they cancel to each other and leaves us with the so-called light cone of the quantum circuit. So in particular, if the quantum circuit has a depth, in this case height, is finite irrespective of the horizontal length, then you are left with some local piece of the whole quantum circuit. And thereby, you obtain the resulting of the conjugation of B by the quantum circuit results in, again, a local unitary operator. So, and using that concept, I want to say that what the long-range entanglement is first. By definition, they are defined to be states that cannot be generated by the constant depth quantum circuit. It requires some deep quantum circuit, or the depth should be depends on the system size. Examples are numerous, but most the simplest case is that you prepare a Bell pair and separate one half to say to the other side of universe and the other to the like here. Then because of that entanglement cannot be generated by a local quantum circuit with a finite depth quantum circuit, so finite depth, so this state is actually long-range entangled by according to this definition. In a similar vein, the GHZ state, say, defined on the one-dimensional spin chain is also quantum circuit, I'm sorry, it's also long-range entangled. And another non-trivial example would be any CFD ground state represented by some mirror, because it has a logarithmic entanglement which cannot be generated by a constant depth quantum circuit, it is also long-range entangled. But these are all seen by, I mean, the argument for those states are long-range entangled can be analyzed by computing the correlations. But there are states that cannot be distinguished by correlation function alone. And one of the examples is the ones that are topologically ordered. They look locally identical. And correlation function in the long-range limit is just simply zero. It has finite correlation length. But nevertheless, it cannot be locally cannot be generated by a finite depth quantum circuit, and I'm going to tell you why that is the case. The argument goes by an observation that when the state is defined on the torus with a non-trivial topology, then there exists locally indistinguishable pair, a partner, there's orthogonal to it, and if to argue based on the contrary, if that is generated by some finite depth quantum circuit from the product state, then we know from the property of the product state that any orthogonal state to it is locally distinguishable. there exists a local operator that has a different expectation value than this one. But then because of the locality preserving property of the quantum circuit, if you evolve it reversely, then the original pair, which was locally indistinguishable, becomes locally distinguishable. So this is a contradiction. Therefore, your state should not be created by a constant depth quantum circuit. This was done by Robbie Hastings and Verstrata a few years ago. And this, their observation and their argument can be phrased as by this statement. The very local indistinguishability, the property of the state, is actually an invariant of the pair of states. But what about the same state? Well, to be more precise, like a torical state on a sphere. Because sphere has a no genus, it has a unique ground state. So, and there is no correlation function to compute and compare with other. So previous arguments doesn't tell you anything in this case. Although we believe that it should be a long range entangled. There's no available argument. So my question is, what is the complexity of generating this particular state from starting from the product state? This is my guiding problem to define an invariant. Any invariant, if it is good, then it should be tell apart whether this state is, where this state can be generated by a local quantum circuit. There is an invariant actually found in the literature, which is called topological entanglement entropy. This is quite different because all you have to do is that you compute the entanglement entropy for some simply connected region. And they have argued that there exists, this obeys a usual area law, but there is some sub-leading correction to the area law, which it turns out to be universal. But why is that universal and why is it invariant? Let me just reproduce their argument, in particular Kitaev-Preskill argument. You divide a disk into three regions and consider a linear combination of entanglement entropies according to this formula, where, for instance, AB means that A union B. Then if this formula holds, then all the area terms will cancel out. Well, this formula is designed to cancel out those area law terms. But since there's an odd number, four number of positive contributions and three of negative contributions, you are left with a single piece of gamma. So now, what happens if we deform one region B? Then this deformation, since we assume that the correlation length is very short, deformation here will not affect the entanglement entropy of region A or C or union of them. The appearance, the contribution from this deformation will appear SB and SAB, SBC and SABC. But since there are two contributions that are positive and two contributions that are negative, they will cancel out. Similarly, if you deform, say, this triple point, then you can argue that it should be all canceled out and the gamma must be invariant. And further evidence was supported by connection with the topological quantum field theory, where they have connected this gamma with a so-called total quantum dimension. So it was all convincing. And based on this observation and arguments, there is a significant interest on the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model and the Kagman lattice. And Yan, Hughes, and White have shown that there is no apparent ordering independent of arbitrary perturbations based on the DMRG calculation. And more recently, there was entanglement entropy, the topological entanglement entropy calculation, which shows the fairly precise number log 2. So people began to believe that this model is indeed topological ordered with the total quantum dimension 2. However, the topological entanglement entropy is quite subtle one, because it can be contaminated.
So,
well, this is not my example, and it's not published, but I heard from his from a correspondence with the where he showed me one of his old slides, and we start with the trivial state. Say Hamiltonian is sum of all sigma x, so you can exactly solve it, and then you evolve your Hamiltonian with the so-called controlled phase gate, which can be represented by only depth two quantum circuit. So it's a finite depth quantum circuit, and the Hamiltonian is deformed to be like that. And if you compute the entanglement entropy of the bipartition, where one partition contains all even sides and the other contains all odd sides, then you recover that some volume part, well, this is expected because the partition is extensive, but there is some constant contribution which resembles topological entanglement entropy. And indeed, if you embed this this particular chain into two dimensions in this configuration and consider Kitaev-Preskill combination with respect to this tripartite system and apply their formula, then you will really discover that there is some constant which is left. Although the overall state is evolved from the product state by quantum circuit of depth two. So this is inhomogeneous and really contrived example, but it nullifies their argument. Their argument cannot rule out this counterexample. So we have to do something more.
Sorry, you said it's inhomogeneous? You mean because of the area you're looking at? Or?
Yes.
Okay, but the system itself is homogeneous.
Well, so I'm imagining that all the rest is in some phase, which I don't really care, and I embed extra degrees of freedom along this chain, and I apply that quantum circuit on that particular chain.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then you measure the topological entanglement entropy formula, then you recover that there is some fluctuation, which is unexpected. And you can play some similar sort of game to a DMRG calculation situation. Actually, Balance et al. Have computed topological entanglement entropy for the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model. They put the model on the cylinder, and they cut the system into halves across one circumference. And then they computed entanglement entropy, and they extrapolated entanglement entropy as a function of circumference. And the Y section was identified to be the entanglement topological entanglement entropy. But if you embed the weird previous chain into this fashion, then no matter where you cut the system, you will have a non-trivial contribution from the chain. So looking at the computation only, it's not really a strong evidence. And if you are unsatisfied with this, well, this obviously breaks the threefold symmetry of the Calumet lattice, but you can embed this chain to obey that threefold symmetry as well. Yes?
How do we have to think about this chain? Is this a copy of many chains?
Yes. So one chain goes around the cylinder on this direction, and they are translationally invariantly laid.
So you just provided an example where most of the standard diagnose we use to detect topological order fails.
Right. Well, this example is somewhat different from the planar star-like diagram before because, well, previous one was obviously breaks the homogeneity because you have to specify one point and you have to embed one star there, but this one is in both directions, translation invariant, and you can obtain rotation, well, discrete rotation symmetry as well. And so, yeah.
So if we just take this example now and we apply some small unitary, local unitary transformation, so the exponential of a local Hamiltonian,
yeah.
We deform it locally.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what the behavior of this, the so-called topological entanglement?
It will vary continuously.
It will vary continuously.
Yeah. But their calculation was very precise, so perhaps the precision might tell something, but I'm not sure. Okay, so let's move on to a more refined and perhaps more robust invariance of a state, and that is a topological S matrix. Let me just remind you what the S matrix was. Typically, the S matrix obviously encodes the amplitude of scattering, but here we're talking about topological scattering, so we put the word topological in front. So you prepare two pairs of particle-antiparticle pair. One is type A and the other is type B. And you braid and annihilate them pairwise. And you measure the amplitude of this whole process. And you normalize this quantity appropriately. And that is, the result is called the topological S matrix. Here, the capital D is so-called total quantum dimension. And the these operators are normalized according to so-called anions quantum dimension. But this bothers me because I have defined topological S matrix in terms of braiding of quasi particles. So a priori, it depends on the Hamiltonian. Can we say that it is an invariant of state regardless of this Hamiltonian? Or is it really an invariant of Hamiltonian, not of state? We cannot compute that quantity without information of Hamiltonian. There was a proposal that indeed topological S matrix can be computed from ground states only, and the algorithm is as follows. You start with the full ground space defined on the torus, and you consider two different bipartitions. One through, say, this red bisection, and the other is through this blue bisection. And then with respect to that bipartition, you compute the minimal entanglement state, and you compute the overlap between the two such obtained bases of the full ground space. And that will be the topological S matrix. Well, this proposal is nice, but it has some drawbacks. There is an inherent phase ambiguity in this formula because, well, when you compute the entanglement entropy, you don't care about the global phase, which is unphysical. So you cannot fix the phase of this quantity. But that phase ambiguity can be fixed once you can identify so-called identity particle. But how would you identify identity particle? It is not obvious from this entanglement entropy calculation. And without that, the S matrix becomes, it's just a matrix of some random phases in the entry. Moreover, it has another problem of what I call the particle label matching. Here, label A and B is supposed to run over all possible quasi-particle types. So the diagonal element should be related to the identical particle that are braided. But how would you identify which state corresponds to which quasi-particle? And you have to order the row and column in some according to some order, but it's not obvious. Particle label matching has a real problem because you want to say you want to distinguish toric code versus double semion, but the S matrix for the toric code is on the left and that for double semion is on the right, but they differ only by permutation of middle two rows. Yes?
But if by some method you also get your hands on the topological T matrix,
mm-hmm.
then I don't think you can still use columns and rows, i.e. Exchange particle labels.
Oh, so using T matrix, you can identify row and columns?
But you have to get your hands on the T matrix somehow, and that might be difficult in calculations.
Oh, okay. Okay, thanks. Okay, let's get back to my original complexity question. So S matrix is defined with the excitations or degenerate ground space. And is it really invariant under small perturbations? Well, it's likely, but we haven't shown that. And eventually we want to have like statement like this. It takes linear depth quantum circuit to have a non-trivial topological S matrix from trivial one. But how would you argue that? Presumably, the proof should go like this. You start with the one Hamiltonian and you compute the ground state. And suppose you have evolved it to some other state, which matches the ground state of H1, and you compare the S matrix. But conjugation of H0 by U doesn't have to be equal to H1 in the proof. So you need some independence of the resulting S matrix on the Hamiltonian level. So now I have given you enough motivation, so let me define the problem. We want to find a quantity that is defined by the state, not explicitly on the Hamiltonian. And we want them to be independent of boundary conditions so that it can be applied, say, state on the on the sphere where there's no degeneracy. So essentially, we want to just look at a patch of the full ground space, ground state. And we should have some invariance under local unitary transformations. Well, that's what I mean by invariant. And hopefully, it will be nice. It can be computed given a single wave function. So here's my partial solution with some conditions, well, which are explicit. And I'll tell you what the conditions are. So we have to restrict ourselves to the ground states of commuting Hamiltonians with the two extra conditions. One is quite natural, I think, and the other is a new one that I have introduced, whose naturality might be debatable, but I believe it's the case. So to define the my version of S matrix, I have to ask a very fundamental question. What's a particle? What's anion? Anion type is identified with the so-called super selection sector. And well, it's a mouthful word, what that means. It is a set of states related by local operators. It doesn't have to be unitary. It includes arbitrary linear transformation. And it is not restricted by any symmetry. Suppose we have some excited states. Well, to tell some excited states, it is enough to tell that the reduced density matrix at that point is different from that of ground state. So we can tell there is an excited state. And we require that there's no excitation along this annulus. Well, the placement of this annulus is because we want the excitation is separated from the rest. And under identification of super selection sector, we have to allow arbitrary operator in the middle because there's no symmetry restriction. But we want to keep that this annulus looks identical to the ground state after that operation. So, and considering operators that act on the outside of this annulus is irrelevant because it's going to not influence my excitation at all. Yeah.
You want the local regions of the annulus to be identical, right? Not the entire annulus.
Right. Yeah. Here looks means local. So maybe this is too abstract. So let me give you a very familiar example.
Yeah, just because in that picture, where did the concept of the super selection sector come in?
Oh, concept of super selection sector
where
come in?
You,
oh, so right. So. Well, let me answer your question after the total spin explanation. So in the total spin, when you identify whether a particle is a fermion or a boson, you have to identify it by spin. But what does a spin mean? It is an invariant, actually, under these operations. You identify and identify a set of operators that are allowed, in this case, rotation. And then you find an operator that commutes with all these, in this case, J square. And its eigenvalue is called the spin. So back to, let me continue. So to identify what the any time without symmetry restriction, we have to identify the allowed operators. So allowed operators are arbitrary operator acting on here, an operator that preserves the ground state locally on the annulus, and another arbitrary set of operators acting outside, which we don't care. So the allowed operator will form some algebra. Well, make an analogy with the angular momentum. This algebra is precisely the algebra generated by the rotation generators.
Sorry, what do you mean by map?
Oh, a full matrix algebra acting on the on this D region.
So the region is called D?
Yes. Yeah. It's a symbolic notation, nothing to it. And we have to identify an operator that is in this algebra that commutes with everything else. Well, we call it center of that algebra. And we can make use of the structure theorem of a C-star algebra here, because my allowed operators will form a C-star algebra. I will recall you what the C-star algebra is.
Yeah. So, sorry that I insist. Yeah. Can you tell me again what that algebra is? MatD, tensor.
Well, D consists of Hilbert space of D will consist of tensor product of several spins.
In region D?
In D.
Right.
And it's just any linear transformation on D. So if there are like a spin halves, then arbitrary product of Pauli operators and linear combinations.
And then A?
A is an algebra that acts on the annulus that commutes with the local terms of the Hamiltonian so that it preserves the local ground states. And then later you just identify what the you just ask what the eigenvalues of those central elements, and that will tell you the annual type. So what does this C-star algebra is, a quick review. It is an algebra over complex numbers. You can multiply complex number and you can add them. You can multiply two algebra elements. And I, for simplicity, I assume that is finite dimensional, which is the case for our purpose, because, well, this is some huge but finite dimensional matrix algebra, and the A part is so. And yeah, for our purpose, it is enough to think about the matrix algebra. That simplifies our picture. But important thing is that it must be closed under Hermitian conjugate. That's what the star refers to. And the theorem says that this any such an algebra decomposes into direct sum of full matrix algebras. And the central element of that algebra is precisely generated by the projections onto those direct sum components. Okay. But there are too many operators than we needed, actually, because if any operator on this annulus annihilates the states by looking at some local data, then it's like that operator should be identified with the zero, multiplication by zero. And we should not include them as a non-trivial transformation of the states to define the superselection sector. So we should factor them out. So here, the relevant algebra is that any operator in the middle and the operators that commutes with Hamiltonian modulo operator that annihilates the state identically. And we just identify the anion types to be the canonical projectors of our C-star algebra. But this is not a derivation, actually. We just motivated how to define what the superposition sectors are. And we have given some relevant algebra to define them. But one advantage is that by construction, the central elements actually acting on the annulus, because this matrix algebra, because it's full matrix algebra, there's no central elements other than scalars. So in other words, if there's some anion here, then that anion must be identified by acting on the annulus around it. Okay, so given this identification, what can we do further? I introduce a new operation on the matrix algebra. So here's a diagram for ordinary product. Let P be an operator acting on this annulus, and let Q be another operator acting on this annulus, slightly shifted to the right. And I draw the diagram to denote the usual product P times Q. If I reverse the order of the product, then the Q is drawn on top of P. This diagrammatic notation. And I define, yes?
Is this a product of some operators?
Yes. The usual matrix multiplication.
I mean, are these operators of the type you just discussed?
No. This is completely general.
I'll just keep listening.
Okay. Yeah.
But this denotes some special, these are operators extended in space.
There
are circles on the lattice.
Yeah. The operator can act on anywhere, but by drawing this circle, I implicitly mean that support is contained in this annulus and acts by identity on the rest. And here's a funny product between two operators. You preserve the usual multiplication rule on the top, but you reverse the multiplication order on the bottom. This may look weird, but because of the linearity and the linearity of the tensor product, it is still well defined as long as the intersection region is well separated.
What is well separated mean?
Disjoint.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, later I will need the fact that they are actually geometrically distant, but for now I just need that they are disjoint. That's it. So, well, given this, I can define my S matrix. I enumerate all the particle type projectors, and I make a twist product of them, and I compute the expectation value with respect to my ground state. Now, observe that I didn't care about the boundary condition. This can be done on some large disk-like region. Right, and so the input to compute this element is the Hamiltonian, and for technical reasons, I assumed commuting. But at this point, I don't really need that. Later on, I will need it to prove something interesting. Yes, there's no special boundary condition to define it, and there's no phase ambiguity because, well, particle type projectors are defined to be canonical projectors of some C-star algebra, which is uniquely defined by the algebra itself. There's no ambiguity. And the trivial particle can be identified if you assume the usual topological order condition. Because, yes?
I'm wondering how the particle type projectors are connected to the ground state. I mean, they should be connected to all of the ground states because you derive them via that in your matrix algebra. The terms that are on the ring commute with the Hamiltonian. So in some sense, to properly define those, you need the entire ground state space. Is that right?
Yes. Well, yes. You need a Hamiltonian, not just the ground state. Indeed, the input here is not the ground state, but the Hamiltonian, and you have to compute ground state and then compute this object.
In any state.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so to comment about the trivial particle. Trivial particle projector is the only projector that does not annihilate the whole state when there is no excitation in the middle. Because trivial particle is by definition the superselection sector represented by the ground state. So it must be the unique one. And it is actually contains the same data as the ordinary S-matrix, and the formula is this. The capital D is the total quantum dimension, and the small d is the individual quantum dimensions. And this is the ordinary one, and this is the new one. Since I can identify the vacuum sector, 1-1, and I know the 1-1 component of this ordinary matrix, I can read off the total quantum dimension as well as the individual small d, yes.
So what you said a second ago about that the trivial particles associated with the ground state, is that because you're like considering a, like a finite open disk? Is that important?
Finite open disk, yes.
Okay.
Right. So you can go back and forth about S tilde versus S. And the proof is through the standard graphical calculus using tensor category. You start with the you write down the projection operator and decompose them into string operators of that carries the definite charge and use the formula that this element is equal to that. And using the unitarity of S matrix, you invert to obtain the C elements and you read off the particle type projection operator in terms of the string operator that carries a specific charge. And you plug into the my original formula to get this equation. So that's not too important. The message is that they contain the same data. And well, let's reveal the desired properties. This is the original formula. And if I insert quantum circuits, then W psi is the deformed state, and W dagger ra psi is the raw part. And the middle part, if I can compute the middle part, then that should be then everything should be fine. What I claim is that if W has a small depth, then because of the locality preserving property of quantum circuits, you can actually show this equality. If any local unitary operator conjugates like here, then the formula obviously holds. If any other local unitary conjugates like here, the same holds. Here, okay. The important thing is that any local unitary transformation does not act on both of the crossing points. And this is the place, the condition that the intersection should be well separated.
What do you mean by P infinite Q?
If P infinite Q is a shorthand notation for this product.
But that's an object itself.
Right? Well, that's an operator itself.
But you can still split it into P. So this is a product of the operator?
Yes. W times P, P infinity product, the twisted product and the ordinary product doesn't commute. So you have to specify the ordering of the product. So I put the parenthesis. Yes. But if you think about it carefully, then actually what one more ingredient is needed. My algebra, the relevant operator that commutes with Hamiltonian modulo trivially zero operators, should be isomorphic under this W conjugation. But this is not true in general. So I had to assume further. But so to resolve your some vague feeling about this, let me enumerate my technical conditions. The first one is so-called local topological order, which asserts that local ground state, I will elaborate more later on. Local ground state should match the global one. If you compute the ground states from the terms that acts on local region, then it should be faithfully reproduce your piece of global ground state. And the second one is a new one, namely that the logical algebra, by which I mean the case of A mod N, it does not depend on the thickness of the support, thickness of the annulus. And the second condition is actually violated if there is infinitely many anion types, which is usually not the case in two dimensions. So let me tell you again what the local topological order is. Given a local region, you collect terms of the Hamiltonian that acts on that region, then given only this local collection of Hamiltonian terms, you can reproduce faithfully the reduced density matrix of the full ground state for that particular region. This condition was actually used in the proofs of the gap stability of topological order. And the second condition, stable logical algebra, reads like this. I consider the annulus of some thickness, and I consider another annulus of thicker one, and I compute the logical algebra, A sub n. So remember, A is the operator that commutes with the Hamiltonian that lives on this annulus. So a priori, if you vary the thickness, then there's no reason for this to be the same. But after modding out trivial ones that are identically annihilates your state, I demand that they must be isomorphic, regardless of this thickness, which is natural. Yeah.
One question about this null operator algebra. Can one understand this in terms of the symmetry?
In terms of symmetry,
somehow that it violates the global symmetry condition on this annulus, and therefore it would kill the state or something like that?
Well, since we're talking about superselection, there's no symmetry, actually. But you can think about this. So elements of A actually can be physically think of it as some sort of Aharonov-Bohm effect, that you send out certain particle around the annulus and measure them and measure the amplitude. But elements of N does the same thing, but with the impossible outcomes. Well, the elements of A, by definition, preserve the fact that this region looks like a ground state. So say your element measures the flux along this loop, some small loop. Then element of N actually projects onto non-zero flux, which will give you identically zero amplitude. So acting by that, you will just annihilate the state, which is not physical. Well, in other words, if two operations are different by those always zero operation, then they should be considered as the same operator, and that's precisely what the modding out is. And one more comment about the finiteness of the number of particle types. And to demonstrate that my stable algebra condition is actually a non-trivial condition in general. Consider a two-dimensional toric code, infinite stack of them. Well, since no particle can hop to other layer, there are formally infinitely many charges. And the analog of the my annulus in two-dimensional situation would be some sphere with some finite thickness. And so on the side, if I draw a side view, then these layers are just horizontal lines, and my sphere will be a circle. And say you had an element of A sub A mod n that measures charge on this layer, which will be non-trivial because it is allowed to have some excitation here. But if you increase the thickness of the wall, then that layer is absorbed into the wall, where we demand that there's no excitation. So previously non-trivial operator becomes trivial here, which demonstrates that my logical algebra A mod n is not isomorphic with a function of thickness. So it had to be assumed. So let me just directly tell you the consequences of those, which is my main result. The logical algebra A mod n is in fact independent of Hamiltonian. It follows from that. So although I have defined the S tilde matrix in terms with the input of Hamiltonian, the result is it doesn't matter which Hamiltonian you started with. And it is indeed invariant under small depth quantum circuit deformations. So I can say that my S matrix is an invariant of state, not only of Hamiltonian, because it is in some sense independent of Hamiltonian. So figuratively, these three Hamiltonians, if these two give rise to the ground state, and this will give rise to this, but they all give the same value as matrix. Well, then complexity of transformation just follows trivially, because you start with the one state and you deform it to another state to match it. If you had a depth small, very small, then they must have a same S matrix, regardless of which Hamiltonian you started with. Let me say again. So here, two Hamiltonians, although they are different as Hamiltonians, they have the same ground state. Therefore, they must have same S matrix. But if U is small depth, then that S matrix should match that of H naught, well, psi naught. So it is impossible to change the S matrix by small depth quantum circuit. Well, in view of the quasi-baric evolution, then it implies that the energy gap connecting any such two Hamiltonians with a distinct S matrix should close the gap in between. So not only trivial versus topological phase has a phase transition, but also a topological phase and another topological phase with a distinct S matrix must have a phase transition. And this is another detail where I make use of where I introduced a new notion to prove things. And this is the central notion. I say an operator is locally invisible whether the operator has acted on or not cannot be told by looking at some small region. So if you start with some different state, but has a same reduced density matrix on V, then after the action of O, the resulting state on A is actually the same. So you cannot tell whether O has acted or not by looking at A. Usual string operators of all known models of topological order satisfy this condition.
I'm sorry, is that a typo? Or this trace is over AC?
Oh, this must be AC. Sorry.
So what do you mean? What's AC?
A complement.
And above you have BC?
Yes. Well, it's a technical thing. It's not that important. All I'm saying is that A and B are some local region, and if some large disk, if they were same, and after the action of O, they become same. They still are the same if you look at a slightly smaller region. Yeah. Nice thing about this notion is that there's no Hamiltonian. I can tell whether an operator is locally invisible or not by condition is stated in terms of state. So I map all my objects, the logical algebra, into operators that are phrased in terms of this. So here's a one-page summary of the proof. I consider a chain of maps from logical algebra to locally invisible operators, which is manifestly independent of Hamiltonian. And I map it back to the Hamiltonian-dependent algebra, and then show that these maps are actually isomorphisms.
What are the subscripts?
Subscript is the thickness. Yeah, that's where the stable logical algebra assumption comes in.
So if I understood you properly,
yes.
Then you were saying that originally you were using the Hamiltonian to define
yes.
these loop operators.
Mm-hmm.
They have to commute with the Hamiltonian.
Right.
And now you've got rid of that condition.
Right.
And you replace it with what?
With the so-called locally invisible ones.
Mm-hmm. That's the key point. That allows
right.
you to generalize, makes your result independent of the
right,
algebra.
Right, right. So because they are, right, and then you compose another maps where left-hand side you have H1 and the right-hand side H2, but in the middle it is independent of the Hamiltonian anyway, so left and right becomes the same. You can actually compute the logical algebra for some simple examples, namely, say, a trivial product state. Then this algebra is 1 by 1 matrix algebra, the complex numbers. So, and you can verify that my two assumptions are satisfied for the trivial Hamiltonian. And therefore, you cannot alter the S matrix, which is 1 by 1, consists of entry 1, by any small depth quantum circuit. And for a toroidal state, more generally, abelian quantum double model or abelian discrete gauge theory states, they have a S tilde matrix like this. Again, my technical two assumptions are satisfied for explicit Hamiltonians. And you can verify by direct computation. And the rows and columns are unsorted, except that we can identify the vacuum. But there is a Bolinder formula which converts this S matrix to the fusion rule. And for abelian discrete gauge theories, the fusion rules are given by the group multiplication rule. So you can reconstruct the original group. So in this case, the S tilde matrix is a complete invariant. One last comment about the row-column matching. You can place arbitrary excitation here and test whether two projectors on the left annulus and right annulus jointly stabilizes that state, then that should be labeled by the same anion type label. Okay, here's my conclusion slide. So single ground state knows the S matrix, although S matrix really involves excited states. Well, there are the technical conditions that we have to impose. One was the local topological order condition, and the other was a stable logical algebra condition, which is satisfied for known some class of models. Yes, and the important point is that here, to define this, you don't need a full ground space or boundary condition. Just a large patch is sufficient. And it's indeed invariant. And you can actually generalize to higher dimensions. I didn't make use of any particular property of two dimensions. So like an analog of in the three dimension would be ring versus sphere. And the analog for four dimensions, for instance, would be three sphere versus ring or two sphere versus two sphere. And perhaps any heuristic algorithm to find those operators might be interesting, because it's going to be quite useful. And I believe that in two dimensions, you can get rid of one of the technical assumptions, because we never have infinitely many anion types in two dimensions. But I don't know how to do it properly. Thanks for listening.
Any questions?
So if I'm trying to see how this relates to previous things that are known. So for instance, if I take Wilson loops and I apply them on the plane, I mean, an example of your operators would be this Wilson loop.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
So I'm trying to understand then, your operators could be different from the Wilson loops, or are they morally equivalent to them?
They are morally equivalent, and that's why S tilde and ordinary S matrix have the same data. But technically, they are different, because Wilson loop typically carries a definite charge. And I didn't quite define what the string operator for a definite charge. I only defined how to project them out. So my projection operator will be some linear combination of the Wilson loops. Content-wise, they're identical.
But for each choice of P and Q, each choice of your indices correspond to well-defined anion.
No. Anion in the middle.
What I'm saying is the entries of the S matrix, you want those to correspond to anion types. P and Q label anion types.
Yes.
But I guess if somebody gives you Wilson loops, they are not proving anything about, whereas your construction proves that this is an invariant. That's probably the central part.
Right. Well, indeed, if you give me arbitrary Hamiltonian, how would you find the Wilson loops? Or how would you even define them?
You could look for operators. Operators which are linear. I mean, you could build a matrix product operator.
Well, yes, you can do that, but
ask the decomposition with Hamiltonian at low energies.
Oh yes, that's one property. But you have to tell that at the end there is a definite anion, not a linear combination of anions. That's the hard part.
I think that in the matrix product formalism that happens automatically, in the sense that matrix product formalism is biased towards small one dimension. And if you have a linear combination of different anion charges or boundaries, that would cost you twice as large one dimension. So variationally, you would get the right solution.
I see.
But that's something. That's
I see.
Thank you.
So I have one quick question. So suppose I give you the fact that suppose I have a semion model and the time reversal of that. And suppose I also tell you that by applying a unitary to these two values, you can map that phi into a exactly solved model, double semion.
Okay.
Then modify some of these arguments to argue that this product gives you the invariant of this one copy of semion model instead of the entire. So the basic question is, like, do you think you can extend these arguments to higher systems? If you're given the knowledge that you can apply unitary to a non-chiral one and separate into plus one and minus one systems.
I see your point, but I would rather postpone the answer, because the point of this talk is about the rigorousness and I don't know how to construct chiral theory on this spin lattice system.
So maybe a related question. So is that why you demand that there has to be a Hamiltonian realizing that phase where the terms, local terms, come out?
Well, technically, it's not motivated by that, but I used that condition when I was considering the second map. Yeah, that simplifies life a lot.
But this is a map where all the Hamiltonians are made. You are considering two different Hamiltonians. In this map, right, the
mm-hmm.
beginning and the end
mm-hmm.
are related to two Hamiltonians.
Right.
Are you assuming that both are made of committing terms? Right.
Yes.
Any other questions? Let's thank John again.